I'm Duncan McLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. That's youtube.com/TechCentral, and never miss an interview. Now, we've got a very special guest on the show today, and that's Peter de Villiers, the founder and CEO of Clickatel. Clickatel is one of South Africa's big technology success stories, but it's a story I don't think has been told necessarily enough. So, Peter, welcome to the podcast. It's really good to see you. How's Cape Town today?
Yeah, thanks, Duncan. Great to be here, and a beautiful day in Cape Town, and you know, it's summer, so we can only smile.
Fantastic, and just a few weeks till the December holidays. I can't wait. So, Peter, when lockdown started, I put a question on Twitter saying, who should I get onto the show to talk to? Because I realized that I wasn't going to be heading out much, so may as well fire up some video conferencing software and talk to some interesting people. And the overwhelming response I received in direct messages was, you have to speak to Peter de Villiers. We haven't had you on the show before, so I'm really glad you've made the time to chat to us about Clickatel and your experience with the business and where it's going in the future. So, Peter, I think maybe as a starting point, I was reading that you actually started your career as an optometrist. How did you go from optometry into the world of high tech?
Yeah, optometry as a science degree is fascinating because it's the convergence between mathematics, physics, and biology. If you think about the eye being an organic, part of our bodies, yet you have lenses to make it operate properly. And so that was fascinating as a student. But once you start your career, you become a retailer. And I was just, perpetually unhappy. And most entrepreneurs, start their entrepreneur journey because they either, lose their job or they hate their job or something like that. And, I guess I'm just another one of those.
So you didn't want to be a shopkeeper is what you're telling us.
Although I do think commercial is very important in any business. But at the time, my expectations were not met.
Right. Okay. So what did you do then? You decided this wasn't for you, but you always had a passion for technology. I think you, I read that you played around with computers when you were quite a lot when you were a youngster. How did you progress from the world of optometry into the world of startups?
Yeah, I was lucky that I found an opportunity to work in a technology interface company that designed software for optometrists. So I could use my domain expertise, but then really get into technology. And so that was a great sort of transition, but I still wasn't fulfilled. And, my dad's an entrepreneur. And I think once you have some of that in your bones, at some point you're going to decide to do something entrepreneurial. And this was the era of the rise of the internet and internet economy. And, if you read enough Time magazines and Fortune magazines, you see these youngsters making incredible business opportunities happen. We decided to do something similar in terms of starting an e-commerce proposition. And that really led us to discovering this Clickatel opportunity for ourselves.
So when was this? Was this in the sort of the late 90s, early 2000s?
Absolutely. So, we wrote a business plan in late 99 for a travel deal business. We're going to give you last minute offers because only two things were making money on the internet, which was travel and adult content, and we could never do the other one. And so essentially we discovered that, people would be open to these travel deals, but they would only read email every third day. Imagine that world. It would be quite nirvana, but we had to find a way to push the information to your phone or to your inbox, so to speak, in order to make the business model work. And I remember from our optometry days, we used to use the pager network to get lab results to doctors on time. And we had this idea then to say, well, can we use the mobile networks and infrastructure for text messaging to get this information to people on time? And that really was the start of our idea.
Interesting. Interesting. So you started the business with sort of three other people, as I understand. One of them is your twin brother?
Yeah, they say friends, families, and fools. And so I'm not sure who's who, but essentially, it was my twin brother and I, my best friend from school, Donnie Detway, who passed away along the journey. And then a friend of his called Patrick Lawson, and Patrick has his own business today. But the four of us started the business, and these were fun, violent, and very exciting years.
And your twin brother, Casper, is he still involved in the business?
Casper's still very much involved in the business. He's responsible for all of our internal IT, security, and compliance. And it's great to have him around. And we've worked well together.
Okay. So I believe at the time it was pretty groundbreaking what you were doing. You were effectively allowing companies to send SMSs from computers or from internet connected devices or some sort of terminal. Maybe just correct me, my understanding of what it looked like in those early days, to smartphones, or just not just smartphones. There was no smartphones back in those days, to cellular handsets. Why was this so groundbreaking at the time? And what were you able to do with the technology?
Yeah, Duncan, it's actually quite fascinating. You know, it's, we were the first in the world to do this, and not because we were rocket scientists. Yeah, we were just four guys.
Yeah.
But we discovered a gap that wasn't filled, and you know, it's hard to imagine that the world's fastest growing commerce platform at the time, the internet, wasn't able to communicate to the mobile phone, which only could do two things: talk and text. And so when we thought of this idea of sending the information for a travel, you know, special to a mobile phone, we spent about 3 months on AltaVista and Excite. These were search engines that you and I will remember.
Yes.
But most of your listeners probably not. But we couldn't find the solution. It didn't exist. And so when we approached the mobile operators and said, hey, we would like to connect our servers to your network and send this information onto the device, they told us to go away because they don't offer that. You know, no one connects to their network from the outside. And so we were crazy enough to hook together laptops and mobile phones and prove that this could be done. And so in November 2000, we launched four lines of code that could enable any website or software for that matter to send a mobile text message globally. And we were truly first in the world. And Clickatel is the convergence between click, the internet, and tell, the telecommunications world.
Yes.
And this was the start of our journey.
What did the operators think of what you were doing?
We have a funny story. You know, we had these SIM cards in these phones because by then, you know, it was all manual and hacking together things. And we canceled the itemized billing on all the phones because – you know, they cost extra at the time. But we forgot one SIM card. And one day they delivered, I think, four Typex boxes. These are big printing paper boxes. And I distinctly, you know, going down on Casper and say, hey, we can't afford printing paper. Why would you order four boxes? And he said, well, he didn't. And we opened up the boxes, and these were back-to-back, small printed, itemized billing for one SIM card. And we realized that we were onto something. These were thousands and thousands of messages.
Wow.
It's being sent daily. So, yeah, the operators kept calling for us to pay the bill, which we had at the time no idea how we were going to pay the bill.
So did you have to pay it eventually?
You know, we finally got an angel investor involved. These guys made some money in the financial services sector, and they gave us, I think, you know, 600,000 rand check. And at that time, our operator bill was about 500,000 rand. That we were just dodging the calls. And so they said, we'll give you this money on condition that A, you pay your bills, and B, you kill the free offering.
Right.
We did both those things in order to move on.
I vaguely remember MTN had a division that was doing something like this back in those days too. There was a chap called Ari Khan who was running that.
Yes.
I forget what it was called.
It was called mtnsms.com.
Yes, that was the website, yeah.
So MTN, you're 100% right. And MTN was also the first mobile operator in the world that allowed a company like ourselves to connect to them
eventually
with an open connection. MTN had an offering where you could essentially send a text message from a website to another consumer. Where Clickatel is a little bit different is that we enabled an API for any software to send a message to any other client or user. And so it wasn't a consumer offering, but really a B2B offering. And MTN was very progressive in that in those days.
Yes. Yes. I remember chatting to Ari Khan back then, and they were... That website was always under extreme load because people from all over the world had discovered it and were using it to send free SMSs, not just people in South Africa. And I remember that there was a lot of antagonism towards MTN from some of those global operators over the fact that they even offered this service. It's just quite interesting days. You developed these four lines of code, which is, I guess, the genesis, the very basis of what Clickatel became. Who was your first customer?
You know, our first customer, and it's interesting, a lot of entrepreneurs ask us about go-to-market and global expansion and how you did that from South Africa. And it's ironic that South Africa was never a core market focus for us. You know, we unleashed this on the internet. We had more than, I think 78,000 or 68,000 websites who embedded the code on their home pages within the first couple of months. I think the first... user came out of India and then out of the UK. So we were always an international, let's call it a virtual internet business, and never a local trying to go international business. So it was a fascinating dynamic in the company from the early days.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. So who was your first South African customer? Do you remember?
I think our first South African customer was MacArthur Caller Car or even... Pam Golding. We have it somewhere in the archives, but it was very much a local internet or internet to mobile extension of their services.
Right. So what were they using it to do?
So for the real estate market at the time, you would drive past a house, like the house, but not sure what, is it a 2-bedroom? Is it a 4-bedroom? Yeah. And so we would enable you to text the number and get the information about that house. And for MacArthur Caller Car, you might search for a vehicle, not find what you're looking for, but then you could say, keep me informed or alert me when you get the vehicle. And then they would alert you and get that vehicle notification to you. Okay. But over the years, Duncan, we've had amazing things. We were involved with President Obama's first trip to Africa, when we worked with the U.S. State Department, helping people in the street of Accra, ask questions for the most powerful leader at the time directly with an interface.
That's pretty cool.
Haiti earthquake, we worked with partners to connect missing children and their parents. So I've heard so many stories. I can keep you busy for days of things that we've done around the use cases. And it's been quite a phenomenal journey for us.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So at some point after you launched the business, I think it was in 2006, correct me if I'm wrong, you landed an investment from Sequoia Capital, which is, of course, the big daddy of tech venture capital funders in the US. And I think it's the firm where Roelof Botha is a partner, isn't it?
That's correct. A lot of people think Roelof and I went to school together and that's how the connection came in. And it's actually not true.
Okay.
We met Roelof there for the first time. But I think advice I give to many entrepreneurs looking to sort of, get the attention of Sequoia is, when we arrived at Sequoia, we've basically built a business with a $10 million revenue run rate of a $60,000 investment, more or less.
Wow.
All the metrics were up and to the right. And so when we showed up, they just saw a company with a real phenomenal product market fit in the use case and very capital efficient. And that's really, what got us that first investment for a company outside of Silicon Valley.
Amazing, amazing. And it's the first Sequoia investment of any company in Africa, I believe.
Correct.
Mm. So,
and for many years.
Yeah.
It took many years later for them to do their second one.
Right. Are they still an investor?
They're still very much an investor. They led our B round of fund capital raise in 2011. And as a firm, we haven't raised capital since. Today our business has very much stayed in this theme of commerce meets communication.
Yeah.
But it's now called chat commerce, and it's almost, a very different value proposition.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to chat a bit about more about what Chat Commerce is exactly a bit later in the discussion. But so you got this investment from Sequoia. How did that come about? Did you just call them up and say, "Hey guys, we want to talk"?
Well, it's important to know what we did prior to get them some attention. You know, I went over to Silicon Valley in 2005, the year prior, with a lot of these mini CDs that were quite cool at the day.
I remember those.
The day and at the time. And in a bunch of printed business plans. And I drove up and down Sand Hill Road and handed these off, you know, at reception. They wouldn't allow you past reception. And,
right.
you know, most of the times we just had an address. We didn't have a name. And I did not get a single call, like not a single query. Or I think those things went straight into the trash can or something. But, you know, it was very disappointing. And only when we committed to having a U.S. presence. So we actually bought a business called Multimode in the U.S. in San Mateo in Silicon Valley, and we had a real presence there. And only after that, when I moved to be based in Silicon Valley, did we get a proper entree to some of the top VCs there.
Right.
So I think the lesson learned there is you have to be there to get it done.
Interesting. Okay. So when you were going up Sand Hill Road and visiting the various reception desks, you were still South African based at that point, were you?
Very much so. I flew in for 2 weeks. You know, I crashed on a guy's couch and in the spare room, a guy called Donovan Neil May, South African guy, great guy. He was very helpful at the time. But no one waits for you at SFO Airport and says, "Welcome, entrepreneur from Africa. We're ready to serve you."
Yes, yes, indeed. So you raised the funding. I know you were talking about 24 months ago of possibly doing an IPO. The market is the U.S. stock market is still very favorable for IPOs. I think it's been one of the biggest years for tech IPOs in history this year. Is that still an option that you guys are considering?
You know, we were very seriously considering public markets, both in the UK and South Africa and perhaps even the US at a later stage. The thing about, and even now, public markets are so frothy. I mean, SPACs are back in vogue. And, you know, if you're really up for it, then it's really an amazing time to raise your capital through those vehicles. I think for a high growth company, who has to still take some risk to grab market share and are on a fairly early stage of the market sort of maturization, being private is a better construct and a better place to be. And so we had to make a tough decision around, do we go public and have all of the sort of champagne and, you know, what comes with that, or do we stay private for long? Because we've been private for many years, right? We're a 20-year-old company this year. And it was actually quite an easy decision in the end. We felt that there was massive growth in a very large market remaining for us, and we would like to have the flexibility of being private and a bit more agile than being a reporting sort of public company.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you mentioned you haven't raised any additional funding in quite some time. I presume that's not necessary. You're generating the cash internally that will allow you to grow?
Correct. We were fortunate, and the business has been profitable for quite some time. That said, you know, we see a expanding opportunity for the business, and we are considering a capital raise or at least testing the market for that in Q1. Whether we will pull the trigger or not, we'll decide. But certainly the market is big enough for us to warrant a Series C.
Okay, great stuff. So let's talk a little bit about let's sort of move in the direction of talking about Chat Commerce. I know that you guys were quite pivotal in helping WhatsApp in the early days. Just talk us through how that relationship came about and what it is you did for WhatsApp.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that, you know, for many years, we were the number one game in town for, you know, having applications speak to mobile devices. And the founders of WhatsApp also had Sequoia as a common investor.
Right.
And when Jan Koum started his business, he was playing with Ticketdial's APIs even before he started WhatsApp. And so, you know, days at Yahoo and whatnot. And so when they started using our services, they did it for a unique use case, which is how do I get my mobile app to be downloaded, but without asking users for email addresses and username and passwords? And so WhatsApp eclipsed all other chat apps at the time because of their beautifully designed user journey and frictionless onboarding, which basically entailed, you know, you giving your mobile number, which was logical, to download the app, then them sending a four-digit PIN through our network to authenticate you as a user. So we had a great journey. More than 500 million users were onboarded through our platform.
Amazing.
On behalf of WhatsApp. And we still have a very strong relationship with WhatsApp, and the team there has changed a lot, but there's still an amazing relationship there.
Fantastic. Okay. So the business has shifted over the years. You've morphed into what you call chat commerce. First of all, what is chat commerce exactly?
Yeah, you know, what has morphed is the technology stack.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that in our case, really, you know, with perfect hindsight, that the business case has morphed that much. Because remember, when we started, we were trying to connect commerce happening on the internet with communication happening on the mobile phone. And so if you think about chat commerce, it's still communications, a la chats, and it's still commerce, a la transactions. And so the way we look at the world, Duncan, is that you had the internet economy in the late 1997, which led to e-commerce and internet banking. 10 years later, you get the app economy with the launch of smartphones and app stores, and you have app banking. And then 10 years after that, you know, from 2007 to 2017, you have the four largest chat platforms eclipsing the four largest social media platforms in terms of active users. And all of a sudden, you have the what we call the chat economy. And with that will come chat commerce, chat banking. And we were lucky enough to, in 2018, be the first company in the world to launch chat banking on the largest chat platform in the world at the time, which was WhatsApp. And also the first ones to launch credit card processing in that same channel. So Clickatoll, although, you know, 20 years in technology is quite some time, we have in many ways continued to stay at the forefront of these technologies and certainly remain a thought leader in this space.
Okay. So maybe take us through some of the examples of some of the big, I mean, you don't have to name them, but some examples of some of the projects you've been involved in around chat banking, chat commerce, et cetera. What are some of the cooler implementations that you've done?
Yeah, you know, we are excited about the prospect of chat commerce because if you think about it, you know, let's look at emerging markets first and then we can get to the US. Sure. In emerging markets, you know, the best banks have between 18 and 22% penetration of their mobile banking app. It's largely because of devices, smartphones versus feature phones or something in between, cost of data, cost of updating those apps, the memories on these devices. So essentially, let's assume for a moment you're doing great at 22% mobile banking app penetration. It still means that 8% of your clients can only be served on SMS or USD or other sort of, you know, digital channel that may just not be adequate for what you want to do with full banking experiences. Yeah. Yet a channel like WhatsApp has 71% penetration, for example, in South Africa. And so we can take your existing mobile banking app investment and we can translate it to chat banking in a very secure, very rich experience without you having to, you know, bog down your engineering resources for another 18 months. We've built tooling and low-code capabilities to orchestrate those experiences for banks. And the first bank in the world, really, to do this was Absa Bank. And today we serve double-digit number of banks in multiple countries on these services.
Interesting. Okay. And I imagine banks obviously are very concerned, rightfully so, about security. WhatsApp as a platform, is it secure for doing this sort of thing?
Banks are always concerned about security, and they should be, because that's why we trust it.
Yes.
And why they are trusted brands. But we are very confident that the end-to-end encryption offered within the WhatsApp BSP capability that we have is more secure than many of the existing banking activities around call center use cases and whatnot. Remember, Duncan, WhatsApp is banned in places like Iran, you know, the DRC, and for reasons that those governments cannot penetrate those firewalls. And so it's a very secure channel and has a lot to offer, expansion of financial inclusion.
So, Peter, how long did you spend in Silicon Valley in total?
Almost 10 years to the month.
About 10 years. Okay. What was your experience like then? Would you recommend it to other South African entrepreneurs?
You know, it's a loaded question because Silicon Valley is let's talk about the good about Silicon Valley first.
Okay.
Silicon Valley taught me about collaboration. I always feel that South Africans have a lot of potential, but we don't collaborate well, you know, unless there's a crisis. You know, so you know, if you watch Chasing the Sun, you see South Africans coming together and it's fantastic. But generally, you know, South Africa is a small market and we tend to fight each other, whether it's a non-profit or a for-profit business.
Okay.
So Silicon Valley taught me about collaboration. People are very helpful and really will genuinely try and set you up to succeed.
Okay.
The challenge of Silicon Valley is that it is really become a very difficult place to operate in between all of the stereotyping of Silicon Valley. There's a lot of truth in that. And so it's just not a healthy environment, I think, in many ways, to grow and scale companies long term. And you will see many Silicon Valleys popping up around Europe and other places because the technology talent exists in those other places, but you don't have some of the microcosm realities that's in the Bay Area.
Okay. The TV show Silicon Valley, how close is that to the truth?
It's actually quite close. A lot of the character development is spot on.
Yeah. Okay. But 10 years there, what did you take out of it? I mean, do you think that those 10 years there were very helpful for the development of Clickatell?
Yeah, they were very helpful. I mean, they were very necessary. We just don't have the capital in South Africa to scale global businesses. The capital is very sophisticated there, very pro-risk. And so, you know, it was very necessary for us to be there. And Silicon Valley will always, have a leading position, I think, in that regard. But also just learning how to deal with, complex enterprise negotiations and deals, very sophisticated market, very competitive. Mm. And you become, from a teenager to a young adult very quickly. It's not for the faint-hearted. It's a tough place.
Highly competitive. I've heard that. So what made you decide it was time to come home?
So we, after we were sort of in a leading position on chat or messaging, we wanted to figure out how do we get the commerce piece built out. And so at the time, Africa was actually in many ways leading payments and mobile payments. And so we felt we want to launch our payments capability in Africa because we understand that market to some extent. And then for our sins, I guess, initially we launched this in Nigeria. And massive market, great opportunity, lovely market, by the way. We have incredible partners there. Mm-hmm. But it was at some point when you're nine hours time zones difference, when you wake up, your inbox is full of all kinds of things that went down. And it just became such a very important part of our business that I felt that being in the same time zone or close to the time zone for that launch would be useful. And we were already operating as a global company. So most of my executive team is in the US. But I just, instead of commuting to South Africa every quarter, I now commute outside of COVID to the US every quarter.
Okay, interesting. Okay. So the business is actually headquartered in Silicon Valley still, is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Very much okay. So, and with subsidiaries in different markets.
Okay. So where are your teams around the world today?
Yeah, so chief marketing officer, chief commercial officer, chief product officer, and CFO are all in North America.
Okay.
With myself and chief human resource officer here in South Africa. And then we have offices in presence in Canada, Nigeria, and looking at some other markets as well.
And your dev team, where do they sit?
They sit in largely between Canada and South Africa.
Canada, interesting. Okay. Why Canada?
Yeah, you know, Duncan, it's an important question because, and I don't want to get too sidetracked, but we firmly believe that South Africa's single biggest growth constraint for technology companies right now is no longer access to funding, but access to digital skills. Mm. And it's ironic that, you know, in South Africa, we put job creation as a number one priority, but I would make a strong case with data that we have a bigger skills dilemma than a job dilemma. And we know this from data between LinkedIn and research we've done with CNBISA. So bottom line is we were forced to start hiring on other markets because South African digital skills and dev talent pool was just not big enough.
Interesting. And Toronto specifically, why there?
Waterloo University is fantastic.
Oh, yes.
There's really strong cohort of young people coming through there with deep technical skills.
Okay. I was having a look at the Clickatel website this morning, preparing for this interview, Peter, and I see that Hannes van Rensburg is on your team. He's, of course, the guy who founded Fundamo, which I think he flipped to MasterCard for an insane amount of money all those years ago. Really interested to see he's on your team there. What's his role? What's he bringing to the party?
Yeah, Hannes sold Fundamo to Visa, MasterCard.
Visa. Visa. Thank you.
But you know, I never set out to hire Hannes. Yeah. You know, I spoke to Hannes about chat commerce and trying to test, you know, the thesis and some of our roadmap thinking, because, you know, he's one of the fathers of mobile payments in the world, rightfully so. And Hannes got so excited, he said he wanted to join the team. I said, well, I probably can't afford you, so, you know, let's not go there. And he said, no, you know, I think you guys are going to change the way commerce is done and you're going to punch a hole in the universe and I'm going to be part of that. And so one conversation became five conversations and today Hannes is part of the team.
Okay. And what's his official title?
Chief Commercial Officer. He needs to make sure we close the deals. Okay. And he's got a great team in various markets and we really are getting great traction. And I think it's partly because of, as a company, we've always been very mindful of doing the right thing.
Peter, before I let you go, what's the future hold for Clickatel? Where do you see this business going in the next few years?
Yeah, we have massive ambition. You know, we've to some extent constrained our growth the first sort of 13 years of the business because we had an EBITDA mindset. It's a consequence of the type of financial partners we had prior to Sequoia coming aboard. We've been able to shed some of those shackles, as I would call them, because it makes perfect sense if you're in a declining or sort of stable market. But if you're in a growth market, you really want to change that approach. So we want to become, you know, a $1 billion business. We have a couple of years ahead of us to go get there. And until then, we love innovating and helping our customers, you know, reach their clients wherever it's most convenient for them.
Peter de Villiers is a co-founder and chief executive of Clickatel. Peter, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks so much for making the time to talk to Tech Central.